In the heart of New York City's prestigious Museum of Natural History lurks a secret that has captivated millions of readers since Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child published Relic in 1995. This scientific thriller, which spent weeks on bestseller lists and inspired a major Hollywood film, combines elements of horror, mystery, and evolutionary science in a way that makes even Stephen King's skin crawl. He called it an out-and-out scary read. What makes this tale particularly chilling is Preston's insider knowledge. He worked at the American Museum of Natural History before writing the novel, lending authenticity to the labyrinthine setting where most readers will never venture. The forgotten basements, abandoned tunnels, and restricted areas behind the museum's polished public facade. Deep in the Amazon basin, amid the suffocating heat and impenetrable vegetation, anthropologist Dr. Julian Whittlesey makes a discovery that will change everything. While searching for evidence of the mysterious Kotoga tribe, a people spoken of only in whispers by local villagers, he uncovers strange artifacts in a series of previously unexplored caves. The most significant find is a grotesque figurine called Mbun, he who walks on all fours, crafted from an unknown black stone that seems to absorb light rather than reflect it. The expedition is already troubled from the start. His Botokudo guides, typically fearless men who know the jungle intimately, have fled after muttering about an ancient curse. Their departure follows weeks of increasingly strange occurrences, unexplained noises in the night, discoveries of mutilated animals, and eerie silence where jungle sounds should be. When his colleague Crocker disappears during a routine survey, Whittlesey's scientific skepticism begins to waver. Following an ancient trail toward Cerro Gordo, a mountain shrouded in local legends, Whittlesey discovers Crocker's mutilated corpse. The body lies splayed across moss-covered stones, the back of his skull torn away with surgical precision. As horror washes over him, Whittlesey notices something even more terrifying. The rainforest has fallen completely silent, as if every living creature is holding its breath. In the dense undergrowth, he glimpses slitted eyes, the color of liquid fire, watching him from the brush, accompanied by a low, guttural sound, unlike any known predator. The artifacts eventually make their way to New York, but the expedition ends in tragedy. Multiple crates from Whittlesey's final expedition sit forgotten in a Brazilian warehouse for months, gathering dust and humidity before finally reaching the Museum of Natural History. What no one realizes is that something deadly has made the journey with them, a presence that will remain dormant until disturbed years later in the museum's sub-basements. The first signs of trouble appear when two young brothers, Billy and his younger sibling Henry, venture into the museum's restricted areas one rainy afternoon. Curious and adventurous, they discover a spiral staircase behind a barricade marked with faded no-entry signs. Their descent into the museum's depths, past corroded pipes, through corridors thick with decades of dust, becomes the catalyst for a series of horrific events that will transform the prestigious institution into a hunting ground. What makes this opening sequence so effective is how it plays on our primal fears of the unknown while grounding them in familiar settings. We've all experienced that moment of dread when we venture somewhere we shouldn't, that instinctive feeling that something is watching from the shadows. Preston and Child masterfully establish the contrast between the museum's public face, a place of learning and wonder, filled with schoolchildren and tourists, and its hidden underbelly, where ancient dangers lurk in forgotten corners, waiting to be awakened. The artifacts eventually make their way to New York, but the expedition ends in tragedy. Multiple crates from Whittlesey's final expedition sit forgotten in a Brazilian warehouse for months, gathering dust and humidity before finally reaching the Museum of Natural History. What no one realizes is that something deadly has made the journey with them, a presence that will remain dormant until disturbed years later in the museum's sub-basements. The first signs of trouble appear when two young brothers, Billy and his younger sibling Henry, venture into the museum's restricted areas one rainy afternoon. Curious and adventurous, they discover a spiral staircase behind a barricade marked with faded no-entry signs. Their descent into the museum's depths, past corroded pipes, through corridors thick with decades of dust, becomes the catalyst for a series of horrific events that will transform the prestigious institution into a hunting ground. What makes this opening sequence so effective is how it plays on our primal fears of the unknown while grounding them in familiar settings. We've all experienced that moment of dread when we venture somewhere we shouldn't, that instinctive feeling that something is watching from the shadows. Preston and Child masterfully establish the contrast between the museum's public face, a place of learning and wonder, filled with schoolchildren and tourists, and its hidden underbelly, where ancient dangers lurk in forgotten corners waiting to be awakened. The museum itself becomes a character, its 19th century architecture concealing layers of secrets beneath its polished marble facades. When Margot Green, a graduate student working on her dissertation, arrives at the museum one morning, she finds police vehicles and emergency services outside. Two young boys have been found dead in the basement. Not just dead, but literally shredded, according to journalist Bill Smithback, who's researching a book about the museum's upcoming Superstition exhibition. The murders create immediate tension between science and superstition. Museum director Winston Wright denies rumors about wild animals in the museum while appearing visibly stressed. Dr. Frock, Margot's mentor, who studies evolutionary patterns, cryptically warns that the force used was of a non-normal nature and advises Margot to be watchful. The investigation brings Lieutenant Vincent DaGosta and Special Agent Pendergast together, a partnership that would continue through many subsequent novels. Pendergast, described as moving like a cat, with pale eyes and almost white hair, reveals that similar murders occurred in New Orleans years ago, with the same signature, skull removal and brain extraction. What follows is a masterclass in building tension. The museum's complex structure, with 5 miles of air ducts, abandoned tunnels, and vast unelectrified sub-basements, becomes a character in itself. Museum staff whisper about a museum beast glimpsed in shadows. When tracker Jonathan Hamm brings hunting dogs to follow the scent, one dog breaks free and is found torn nearly in half, establishing that whatever is stalking a museum is powerful enough to overcome natural predators. The museum setting is perfect for this kind of horror. It's a place where the past is preserved, where ancient creatures and forgotten civilizations are displayed behind glass. But what happens when something from the past escapes confinement? The juxtaposition of scientific rationality against primal terror creates cognitive dissonance that heightens the reader's unease. We want to believe there's a logical explanation, just as the characters do, but the evidence increasingly points to something beyond conventional understanding. As the body count rises, including a security guard found disemboweled in a stairwell, the investigation intensifies. Dr. Matilda Zewich performs an autopsy on one of the boys, discovering the back of his skull punched through and the brain partially missing, specifically the thalamus and hypothalamus regions. Most significantly, she finds a claw embedded in the victim's chest. This physical evidence forces the characters to confront an uncomfortable reality. They're dealing with something that defies conventional classification. When the claw is analyzed, DNA results show a bizarre mixture of species, part reptile, part primate, with many unidentifiable sequences. Margot and Dr. Frock begin piecing together the connection between the murders and the Whittlesey expedition. They discover that the crates from the Amazon contained not just artifacts, but also strange plant fibers used as packing material. These fibers, when analyzed, proved to be neither fully plant nor animal, containing human hormones, particularly from the hypothalamus gland. The revelation comes in stages. The creature that escaped from the crates had been feeding on these hormone-rich fibers. When the crates were moved to the secure area, cutting off its food supply, it began killing humans to extract their hypothalamus glands as a substitute. This biological imperative drives the creature's behavior. It's not killing out of malice, but necessity, like an addict desperate for a fix. What makes this scientific detective work compelling is how it grounds the horror in plausible biology. The creature isn't simply a monster, it's an evolutionary aberration with specific biological needs and adaptations. Dr. Frock's Callisto effect theory, that every 60-70 million years a new predatory species emerges when life becomes too well adapted, provides a framework for understanding the creature's existence. The scientific approach to horror elevates Relic above typical monster stories. The characters use DNA analysis, evolutionary theory, and anatomical knowledge to understand their adversary. This grounding in real science makes the impossible seem possible, creating a more sophisticated kind of fear than simple shock value could achieve. While a literal monster stalks the museum's dark corridors, equally dangerous human monsters operate in the administrative offices, wielding bureaucratic power with calculated precision. The American Museum of Natural History's internal politics and labyrinthine bureaucracy create obstacles that prove as treacherous as the creature itself, perhaps more so, given their ability to hamper those trying to prevent disaster. Public relations director Lavinia Rickman emerges as a formidable gatekeeper, wielding her red pen like a weapon against journalist Bill Smithback's manuscript about the exhibition. Her censorship goes beyond mere editorial oversight. She demands the systematic removal of anything that might raise eyebrows or question the museum's authority. When Smithback presents compelling arguments about how failure and controversy have historically driven scientific progress, citing examples like continental drift theory and the resistance to Darwin's work, Rickman remains unmoved. Her requirements are unambiguous and revealing of institutional priorities. Nothing controversial, nothing that might offend ethnic groups, and absolutely nothing that could tarnish the museum's carefully cultivated image of academic excellence. The conspiracy of silence extends to the highest levels of museum leadership. Deputy Director Ian Cuthbert and Director Winston Wright orchestrate a sophisticated cover-up of disturbing incidents. Most notably, they've buried all evidence regarding the disappearance of Gregory Montague, a promising young curator who vanished near the Whittlesey crates years earlier. Their internal memos, discovered later by Margot Green, reveal a pattern of deliberately misleading statements and strategic omissions. Their singular focus on protecting the museum's reputation and ensuring the Superstition exhibition, with its wealthy donors and international media attention, opens on schedule, reveals a chilling indifference to human cost. The political maneuvering extends beyond museum walls into federal law enforcement. When FBI Special Agent Pendergast implements necessary but disruptive security protocols, Wright leverages his connections in Washington to have him replaced. His chosen replacement, Special Agent Coffey, proves more pliable to administrative pressures, prioritizing the exhibition's timeline over thorough security measures. Pendergast's response to his removal reveals both his insight and adaptability. While Coffey has final authority, I now have freedom to follow my own instincts without direct responsibility, a statement that proves prophetic as events unfold. These human antagonists represent institutional horror at its most insidious, the kind that operates through memos, meetings, and carefully worded press releases. They embody a systemic failure that prioritizes institutional preservation over human safety, valuing reputation and revenue above all else. Their actions force the protagonists to operate in the shadows, creating a parallel conflict that runs alongside the monster hunt. One where paperwork and politics prove as deadly as claws and fangs. This layer of human corruption adds sophisticated depth to what could have been a simple monster story. It suggests that true monsters come in many forms, and sometimes the most dangerous ones don't lurk in basement corridors, but sit in corner offices, making decisions that cascade into tragedy. Their weapons are not teeth or claws, but rather policies and procedures that, wielded carelessly or maliciously, can cause devastation far beyond what any single predator could achieve. Despite the mounting evidence of danger, the Superstition exhibition opens as scheduled. The museum's great rotunda and Hall of the Heavens fill with thousands of New York's elite, mingling amid tropical decorations, champagne, and music, completely unaware of the danger lurking nearby. Margot and Dr. Frock desperately try to warn officials about the creature, armed with their scientific analysis that reveals it to be a formidable predator, weighing 240 to 260 kilograms, capable of speeds up to 70 kph, with a brain capacity approaching human range. Most alarmingly, it possesses specialized adaptations for hunting by smell rather than sight, making the crowded exhibition, with its concentrated human hormonal scent, the perfect hunting ground. Their warnings go unheeded. During the opening ceremony, DaGosta discovers a mutilated corpse hidden atop a display case, the headless body of Officer Beauregard, who has been dead for days. Before he can safely evacuate the guests, the body falls into the crowd, triggering mass panic as people stampede toward the exit. The situation deteriorates rapidly. The museum's sophisticated security system fails, plunging everything into darkness and automatically sealing the building into 5 isolated cells. The massive metal security doors descend, trapping people inside with the creature. Director Wright, Cuthbert, and Rickman take refuge in Wright's old laboratory, while DaGosta leads a group, including the mayor, through flooded sub-basement tunnels seeking escape. This sequence demonstrates masterful pacing. After the slow build of scientific discovery and political maneuvering, the action explodes into chaos. The exhibition opening becomes a perfect storm. Hundreds of potential victims trapped in darkness with a predator that hunts by scent, navigates easily without light, and knows the museum's hidden passages better than those trying to escape. The flooding tunnels add another layer of danger, creating a ticking clock as water levels rise. The characters must choose between drowning or facing the creature, with no good options available. This combination of threats, monster, darkness, rising water, failing technology, creates a perfect pressure cooker of tension. As the situation in the museum reaches its crisis point, Special Agent Pendergast emerges as the hero uniquely qualified to face the creature. His unconventional background, particularly his extensive experience hunting dangerous game in Africa's most treacherous territories, provides crucial insights that conventional law enforcement lacks. Drawing from lessons learned tracking wounded lions through the Serengeti, Pendergast understands that when facing a superior predator, the most effective strategy isn't attempting kill shots, but rather breaking down the animal by targeting its mobility, specifically shattering leg bones to immobilize it. Pendergast and Margot develop an elaborate strategy based on their combined knowledge. They initially attempt to exploit the creature's biological drives, using carefully placed caches of the plant fibers it desperately craves as bait. This plan reveals an unexpected sophistication. The beast demonstrates tactical awareness and problem-solving abilities far beyond their initial estimates, avoiding their carefully laid traps and even setting counter-ambushes of its own. This forces them to adopt a far riskier approach, using themselves as living bait in a carefully chosen narrow corridor where Pendergast can maximize his shooting angles. The futility of conventional military tactics becomes brutally apparent when an elite SWAT team attempts a simultaneous assault from the museum's roof. Despite their state-of-the-art weapons and tactical training, they're systematically destroyed by the creature. Their night vision equipment proves useless against its natural adaptations, and their body armor offers no protection against its unprecedented strength. The massacre demonstrates how thoroughly outmatched traditional armed response is against this evolutionary anomaly. The climactic confrontation unfolds in the museum's mineralogy wing, where Pendergast and Margot successfully maneuver the creature into their trap. Margot's scientific expertise proves decisive. Her detailed understanding of primate anatomy allows her to identify a crucial vulnerability. She realizes the creature's forward-facing eyes, similar to great apes, create a direct channel to its brain cavity. This insight enables Pendergast to place his shot precisely where it will have maximum effect, using the creature's thick skull to their advantage as the bullet ricochets internally, causing catastrophic damage. This resolution masterfully synthesizes the novel's twin themes of scientific knowledge and primal combat. The creature, itself a product of both evolution and human interference, is ultimately defeated not by overwhelming force, but through the combination of Pendergast's refined hunting instincts and Margot's scientific acumen. It demonstrates how human intelligence, when properly applied, can overcome even the most formidable biological weapons nature or science can produce. The victory comes not from superior firepower, but from understanding both the creature's strengths and its inherent vulnerability. 4 weeks after the devastating museum disaster, the survivors convene in Dr. Frock's sunlit office, where morning light streams through tall windows overlooking Central Park. The media circus that had descended upon the Museum of Natural History has largely dispersed, their attention drawn to newer sensations. The government's swift and secretive removal of the creature's remains, conducted under the cover of darkness by unmarked vehicles, helped quell public hysteria and prevented detailed scientific examination of the specimen. In this moment of relative calm, the truth about the creature emerges through careful analysis of the limited samples they managed to preserve. The beast represented an unprecedented evolutionary combination. Part reptile, contributing its extraordinary strength, lightning-fast reflexes, and remarkable endurance, part primate, explaining its problem-solving abilities and tactical intelligence. DNA analysis suggests it was likely the last of its kind, an evolutionary dead end whose habitat had been irreversibly destroyed. The Tepuy, where it originated, now bears deep scars from aggressive mining operations, its unique ecosystem decimated. The plant species it depended on, a rare specimen with properties unlike anything known to modern botany, has vanished entirely from the plateau. Smithback, ever the opportunist, but with a newfound conscience, has secured a lucrative book contract with Random House. His decision to donate half the royalties to Officer Bailey's family reflects how the events have changed him. Lieutenant DaGosta's handling of the crisis has earned him a well-deserved promotion to captain, though he remains haunted by the officers lost under his command. Margot, whose theoretical knowledge proved crucial during the crisis, accepts a tenure-track position at Columbia University's Department of Evolutionary Biology, where she plans to continue her research into extreme adaptation in isolated species. During their gathering, the group reconstructs a timeline of the creature's victims, a grim accounting that includes not just the recent deaths of homeless people in the museum's sub-basement, but also a German tourist who vanished near Riverside Park, the shocking murder of George Moriarty, and finally the long, mysterious disappearance of Ian Montague, whose fate had puzzled museum staff for years. However, what seems like closure proves to be merely prologue to an even darker revelation. 6 months later, in a development that sends shockwaves through the scientific community, Greg Kawakita, the brilliant but unstable researcher who developed the genetic program crucial to identifying the creature, is discovered to have been conducting unauthorized experiments in a makeshift laboratory. He has successfully reconstructed the extinct plant from a single preserved fiber and, more disturbingly, has been synthesizing and selling its powerful narcotic derivative on the street as glaze. The most chilling revelation comes from Kawakita's detailed notes. The museum beast was actually Dr. John Whittlesey, transformed by an ancient reovirus preserved within the plant for 65 million years. The Kothoga tribe, in a desperate bid to protect their way of life from encroaching civilization, had force-fed Whittlesey the plant, turning him to what they called Mbun, the guardian beast. But like all previous attempts to create such creatures, Whittlesey proved impossible to control, either escaping his creators or being abandoned to wander far from his original habitat. This final disclosure transforms the entire narrative from a monster story into a tragedy. Whittlesey, driven by scientific curiosity, had crossed boundaries that ancient wisdom had marked as forbidden. His transformation suggests that the line between humanity and monstrosity is far more fragile than modern science would have us believe, that perhaps the capacity for becoming other lies dormant within human DNA, waiting only for the right catalyst. Relic succeeds because it understands that the most effective horror comes not from the supernatural, but from the natural world pushed to extremes. The creature at its heart isn't a demon or ghost, but an evolutionary possibility, something that could exist if certain biological principles were stretched just beyond their normal limits. Drawing from real scientific concepts like convergent evolution and adaptive radiation, the novel creates a monster that feels disturbingly plausible within our understanding of natural history. The novel's setting contributes enormously to its impact. Museums are repositories of the past, places where we contain and categorize the natural world through careful curation and scientific methodology. The American Museum of Natural History, with its vast collection of over 33 million specimens and artifacts, represents humanity's attempt to understand and control nature through scientific classification. When something escapes that classification, something that shouldn't exist according to conventional taxonomy, it threatens not just individual lives, but our entire framework for understanding reality. The museum's labyrinthine basement levels, storage facilities, and forgotten sub-basements create a perfect hunting ground where modern civilization literally sits atop layers of evolutionary history. The characters' scientific backgrounds make their confrontation with the impossible more compelling. These aren't superstitious people prone to seeing monsters in shadows. They're rational scientists forced to expand their understanding when faced with evidence that challenged their worldview. Dr. Margot Green's expertise in evolutionary biology and Dr. Frock's deep knowledge of genetics provide a scientific lens through which the horror unfolds. This cognitive dissonance, the struggle to reconcile scientific training with impossible reality, creates a more sophisticated kind of horror than simple fear. Their analytical approach to understanding the creature makes the terror more acute when science fails to provide answers. Preston and Child's collaboration produced a perfect blend of scientific plausibility and pulse-pounding action. Their backgrounds, Preston's experience as a former editor at the American Museum of Natural History, and Child's editorial expertise, created a novel that feels authentic in both its scientific details and narrative structure. The author's meticulous research into museum operations, evolutionary biology, and forensic science grounds the fantastic elements in reality. Relic launched not just a successful film adaptation, but an entire series featuring Agent Pendergast, whose unusual methods and encyclopedic knowledge would guide readers through many more encounters with the unexplained. The character became an icon of intellectual detective work, combining scientific methodology with an openness to extreme possibilities. The novel's legacy lives on in how it forever changed our perception of museums, reminding us that behind every orderly exhibition lies a labyrinth of storage rooms, forgotten specimens, and perhaps things that science has not yet found names for. Its influence can be seen in countless subsequent works that blend scientific expertise with horror, creating a subgenre that explores the terrifying possibilities lurking at the edges of human knowledge.